Hi, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to the UBS Global Research Pod Hub, a channel that shares insights from economists, strategists, and equity analysts on the pivotal questions and events shaping today's markets. My name is Paul Schneider, Head of Markets Focus at UBS, and I'm here with my colleague, Madeline Jenkins, European Technology Analyst. In this episode, we're going to take a high-level look at quantum computing, on which we recently authored a key report. Madeline, perhaps first you could define what quantum and computing mean and what they are taken together.
Thanks for having me, Paul. So effectively, quantum is the description of something small, and that quantum mechanics is the study of these very small things. And a computer, as I hope most people will know, it's a machine that's used to process and store data. And it does this by using things called bits, which are effectively glorified switches, and they can represent zero or one. So taken together and in one sentence, a quantum computer is a device that harnesses the behavior of these small particles to process and store data.
So when I think of computers, I think of bits. Yes. What is the quantum equivalent of a bit?
The quantum equivalent of a bit is something called a qubit. And this effectively has to be something small with two energy states, representing zero or one.
And how does a qubit differ from a bit?
So whereas a bit can only be zero or one at any given time, a qubit can be zero and one at the same time. Now, a good kind of description of this was a famous thought experiment called Schrödinger's cat. So picture a cat in a box with a radioactive substance that randomly decays. When the box is closed, you don't know whether the cat is dead or alive, just like a qubit. But when you look, then it's either dead or alive. Now, effectively, this kind of comes to the key point is when you're looking at a qubit, it behaves classically like a normal bit. But when you're not looking, it is in the superposition of these two states.
So taken from what you've just said, it only behaves in a certain way when you're not looking?
Yeah, I know. And it's very confusing for a lot of people. But when I say not looking, I literally mean not looking, i.e. having a camera on this qubit or measuring it through various means. And the way to think about these qubits is more as waves than particles. And effectively, these waves are waves of probability. They're invisible. They're not like water waves. And when you're not looking, these waves effectively describe the probability of the qubit being in a certain state. However, when you look, these waves disappear and you know the location with certainty.
We talked there about looking and not looking.
Yes.
Is there another way for listeners to understand that?
There's actually a famous experiment in physics, which some of you may have covered at school. It's called the double slit experiment. And effectively, you shoot a beam of particles at two slits and then measure their interference pattern on a screen behind these slits. Now, if you don't look at the slits, the particles effectively go through both slits at once, and you see an interference pattern that looks very similar to water waves if you were, you know, shooting water waves at these two slits. However, if you put a camera on these two slits, the particles will then only go through one or the other. And the interference pattern you see is just two beams behind the two slits. And I think this is just a good way of demonstrating this kind of looking, no looking concept.
As you were speaking there, I was transported back to my 1990s physics classroom.
Well, there you
go. So I do vaguely remember that. So when I did some reading about this, and you know, you and I've talked a little about this in the past, is that where the maze analogy comes from? Is that how to think about the maze analogy when often people think about quantum computing?
So as you can imagine, if these qubits can be in both states at the same time, especially when you add more and more qubits, the number of states you have at your disposal grows almost exponentially. A good analogy of a classical computer versus a quantum computer is, to your point, the maze. So a classical computer, if it was trying to find its route through a maze, would have to look at all the paths individually. Whereas a quantum computer can almost assess all these paths at the same time and then give you the right answer. Now, I just want to use this to say there's a common misconception in quantum computing that effectively you can read out all these different paths, which is not true. Effectively, like I said, you know, when you're looking at these qubits, when you measure them, they will collapse to the classical bit effectively. And so you can't read out all these paths. You have to design these algorithms to pop out the right answer when you measure it.
So what we're talking about here is clearly a tectonic shift in how we think about computing, from the computers that we know and understand today to the quantum computers of tomorrow. In that sense, you mentioned there about speed, and I guess there's also a question around power. So what does it mean in terms of computing power and how things, in theory, over the period ahead, are going to change?
So I think a good way to look at it would be, okay, if you have 100 of these quantum bits, or these qubits that are error corrected, you know, how much computing power would that really equate to in our traditional methods? And so 100 of these qubits would basically be equivalent to 10 to the power of 21 GPUs. So a huge amount, and to your point, this is a tectonic shift, right? It's a huge amount of compute power available. And these quantum computers can cost only tens of millions to build, and they use a fraction of the power of today's supercomputers or servers. And the reason behind that is you don't need to power these qubits. They just have this compute power available because of their inherent quantumness or quantum properties.
So put another way, the qualities that the qubits have enable them to behave in a certain way, which is going to drive this tectonic shift.
Exactly. And, you know, you do still need power, and, you know, we can go into how these things are made, but you need very high quality fridges and vacuums, which do use power. But the actual computing power isn't because you're providing these qubits with any energy. It's just their kind of state of nature, really.
Touching on something that you said a few moments ago, you mentioned how it's important to design the algorithms very cleverly in order to generate the output. Perhaps we could understand that a little bit further.
So quantum computing is not a plug and play. Effectively, like you say, you need to design these algorithms. So when you observe the qubits, they give you the answer that you want. And there are a few famous algorithms out there. The big one and probably the flagship one is something called Shor's algorithm. And effectively, it's the description of how you can break current encryption methods, so something called RSA. Now, this is based on, you know, if you have a piece of data, you multiply two very big prime numbers to get its product. And the idea of current encryption is effectively you can't back out what those two prime numbers are with current computers. Now, Shor's algorithm describes a way that a quantum computer can do that. And as you can imagine, the implications for security are huge. I'm sure we'll touch on that later.
Earlier, you touched on the complexity of and the importance of the algorithm in the process. But perhaps let's take a step back. How do you actually build a quantum computer?
So a quantum computer is built very differently to a classical supercomputer or server. You actually don't need very advanced equipment. So you start with something called a quantum processor. It's the same as, you know, a GPU or a CPU. It's something called a QPU. And this is what houses the qubits. You don't need very advanced equipment to make a quantum processor. It can be very old generations of equipment. And then depending on the type of quantum computer, this typically sits in a very high quality fridge and a high quality vacuum. And this touches on one of the big issues of quantum computing, which is you need to isolate these qubits from their environment. Because as I said, you know, any observation or measurement or any interaction with these qubits, they lose their quantumness. So they have to be isolated to exhibit these amazing properties they have. So yes, you have this high quality fridge and vacuum, and then next door, you effectively have your control components. Now, an interesting thing of these qubits is they all operate in something called the microwave regime, which is just a frequency of light. And so you actually need a lot of analog components to control these qubits. So companies like ADI in the US, for example, do a lot of this. So that sits next to the fridge and the high quality vacuum. And then finally, you need quite a sophisticated classical computer to control and then error correct these qubits.
For those listening, that sounds more complicated than perhaps it is. What are we thinking about in terms of cost and also time taken to produce?
So from a cost point of view, it's not huge, right? Because like I said, you don't need advanced equipment to make these quantum processors. And often you can leverage existing semiconductor facilities. I'd say the high cost components are probably the vacuum and the fridge. But in total, it depends on your type of quantum computer. But one of these things can cost tens of millions to make.
And time to market. What is the typical time lag that's required for production on the scale that we're going to need to see?
It's difficult to say at this stage. When the market matures, I can imagine your time to market will probably be quite quick. At the moment, there are still a few engineering challenges that need to be faced.
Madeline, there's a lot to take in there. And obviously, we've tried to unpack what is ultimately going to be a key milestone potentially for technology and for industries as we know them. In part two, let's take a look at the implications of quantum compute and where we head from here.
Sounds good.
Thank you for visiting the UBS Research Pod Hub. That was part one of our look at quantum computing with myself, Paul Schneider, and my colleague, Madeline Jenkins, here at UBS. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tune in again and share this episode with a friend or colleague, and we look forward to welcoming you for part two.
This content has been prepared by UBS AG, its subsidiaries and or affiliates, and is purely informational in nature. It is not investment research and does not contain an investment recommendation, nor investment or professional advice. It is not an offer or solicitation to engage in any investment activity, and you should seek your own financial, tax and legal advice before engaging in any such activity. UBS has no responsibility to you in relation to this content, and has no regard to your personal circumstances or investment objectives, and receiving it does not imply any form of client relationship with UBS for any legal, regulatory, or tax purpose. This content is not intended for distribution into any jurisdiction, where to do so would be contrary to law or regulation. UBS does not accept any liability over the content of such material or reliance upon any information contained herein. The views and opinions expressed by any guest speaker or third party are not those of UBS. Accordingly, UBS does not accept liability over any such views and opinions expressed by such persons. This content is the valuable intellectual property of UBS, and UBS specifically prohibits the redistribution of it in whole or in part without its prior written permission. Copyright UBS 2026. The key symbol and UBS are among the registered and unregistered trademarks of UBS. All rights reserved.